thousands of Alaskans should outweigh the interest of just a couple of people trapping and hunting wolves on the boundary of the park.
The Board of Game denies a request to protect wolves near Denali National Park. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, October 10th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Kivalina prepares for water shortages this winter.
There is nothing we can do other than conserve. It's just too cold. The lagoon is frozen over now.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. Alaska Pacific University offers convenient, high-quality, affordable adult undergraduate programs. Applications are due October 19th. Apply at alaskapacific.edu or by calling 564-8248. This message sponsored by APU.
A civilian contractor was injured today at Coast Guard Air Station Sitka when a biomass boiler exploded in the station's main hangar. The Coast Guard says the man was transported to a Sitka hospital and has since been released. Commanding Officer Ward Sandlin says Air Station Sitka personnel and local authorities are working with investigators to determine the cause of the explosion. The station's other two biomass boilers have been shut down pending the results of the investigation. Air Station Sitka is the first base in the Coast Guard to convert to the biomass system, which burns wood pellets instead of fuel oil. Today's incident comes less than a week after U.S. Senator Mark Begich toured the boiler and praised the project. Air Station Sitka was testing the new wood pellet system and hoped to have it fully operational by November 1st. Police are investigating human remains found in a wooded area near Dowling Road in South Anchorage. Anchorage Police Department spokesman Lieutenant Dave Parker says the body was discovered about 11 a.m. this morning. A man taking a shortcut home after dropping his car at a nearby garage discovered the remains. The body was not immediately identifiable as male or female, police say. Historically, there have been homeless camps in the area, but officials say there are no active camps there now. The Alaska Board of Game will not honor a request to reconsider an emergency regulation to protect wolves along the eastern border of Denali National Park and Preserve. As KUAC's Emily Schwing reports, a handful of wildlife advocacy groups and individuals have fielded a second petition asking to close state lands to hunting and trapping wolves near the park.
In a letter sent Monday to petitioners, the Board of Game said they have no procedure under its rules to reconsider a denial on an emergency regulation petition. So they suggested the groups file a new petition that includes additional information. That's exactly what conservation biologist Rick Steiner did late Tuesday night.
So they have no excuse to avoid this anymore. You know, it's obvious to many of the petitioners that the Board of Game and the department are just looking for every possible way, legal or not, to deny this legitimate public interest in protecting Denali Park wolves, and it's time for that to change.
The original petition asked for the establishment of an emergency management zone along the eastern border of Denali National Park and Preserve. A wolf pack there has dispersed after one breeding female was trapped this spring. Another died of natural causes. Alaska statute defines an emergency as an unforeseen or unexpected event. But Acting Chairman Ted Spraker says the board doesn't consider it an emergency because the state allows trapping in that area.
There was nothing unforeseen about that wolf being trapped at all. In fact, it was discussed at the board that if we open this, you know, we want to make it very clear that there's a good chance that some of these park wolves are going to be trapped.
New information has been added to the most recent petition, including National Park Service visitor statistics. In 2010, 45% of visitors who came to see wolves in the park were successful. This year, that opportunity dropped to 14%. Rick Steiner says the decrease highlights what he calls unconstitutional management decisions.
The Alaska Constitution directs that the state shall, you know, manage wildlife for the maximum benefit of people, and it's clear that the interests of thousands of Alaskans and visitors to Alaska and businesses in Alaska that rely on it should outweigh the interests of just a couple of people trapping and hunting wolves on the boundary of the park.
In emails Steiner acquired through a public records request, fish and game management biologists and the Board of Game say they don't manage wolves at the pack level, but rather at the game management unit level. Game Management Unit 20 includes the Denali region. It's over 35,000 square miles in area. Rick Steiner says managing wildlife at that scale ignores finer level issues.
You could lose every animal in Denali National Park and it would not rise to the level of an actionable resource emergency to the Department of Fish and Game or to the Board of Game. And that, in anyone's thinking, should be an absurdity.
Ted Spraker agrees. As a retired fish and game wildlife biologist, he says the department should focus on a smaller portion of the unit, which is split into six subunits. Subunit 20C would include the buffer zone.
I've recommended to the department that if this petition comes back, that they narrow their comments. And I think they'll focus their comments more on the impact of wolves around 20C rather than all of 20.
The seven-member board is currently operating under a moratorium on wolf-related issues. They'll revisit that matter in 2016. However, Spraker says they can still consider the latest petition.
And if there's enough new information to persuade two board members to call for a meeting, it only takes two board members to call for a meeting.
For roughly a decade, a buffer zone protected wolves that roamed between federal and state land around Denali National Park. But the board canceled it in 2010. There are two known trappers in the area. I'm Emily Schwing in Fairbanks.
The Arctic village of Kivalina may run out of fresh water this winter. Governor Sean Parnell declared a disaster in the village last month after heavy rainfall flooded the Woolock River and washed away some of the city's surface water piping. By the time the State Office of Homeland Security and Emergency Management had shipped a new high-speed pump and pipe to the community, it was too late, according to City Administrator Janet Mitchell.
There is nothing we can do other than conserve. I just received word that they're pulling in the equipment and bringing them back to town. It's just too cold. The lagoon is frozen over now.
Slush clogged the pipes and the crew gave up. It's not clear how much water made it into the tanks. Mitchell, who grew up in Kivalina, says residents have always tried to conserve water.
The only time I get water from the water tanks is to wash my clothes or, you know, hand washing, you know, washing the dishes. That's the only time I use that water. I don't drink it. I get my water from Kivalina River, and when I can, in the wintertime, I melt snow. That's what we used to do back in the day before this tank was built.
But the majority of Kivalina's 436 residents don't have boats or snow machines to access large quantities of fresh drinking water, so they use the local washateria. It's unlikely to remain open through the winter. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the delicate task of rewriting the rules for halibut fishing in Alaska.
There was definitely tension, but I felt like representatives from each user group were really trying to compromise.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Every day, over 4,000 infants and toddlers go to sleep in child care programs across Alaska in unsafe cribs. The Alaska Community Foundation is partnering with THREAD to replace unsafe cribs in licensed child care programs across Alaska with new safe cribs. To help, donate today and the Alaska Community Foundation will provide a one-to-one match of your donation. To donate, visit alaskacf.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Community Foundation.
Two Homer men accused of sexual assault at a large house party last month have had their bail set. Michael Armstrong of the Homer News reports that in a crowded courtroom yesterday afternoon, Judge Margaret Murphy set bail at $5,000 for 20-year-old Anthony Reseteritz and his 18-year-old brother Joseph Reseteritz. Both men have to be under a 24-hour third-party custodian. The two brothers were arrested last week in Anchorage and Homer on charges of second-degree sexual assault. In charging documents, Alaska State Trooper Sergeant Jeremy Stone alleged Anthony Reseteritz sexually assaulted an incapacitated 17-year-old boy at a house party. with Joseph Reseteritz assisting. In his affidavit, Stone said many people witnessed the assault, with some photographing parts of it. Kenai Assistant District Attorney Kelly Lawson asked that the men not be at Homer High School or contact children under age 18. She also asked that the brothers not contact each other. Judge Murphy granted those conditions. If convicted, the men face from 5 to 15 years each in jail. In 2010, voters passed an initiative requiring minors to inform a parent 48 hours before getting an abortion. This week, the Anchorage Superior Court upheld most of that law and even okayed portions that were initially viewed as too burdensome. But while the court determined the law was constitutional, it didn't endorse it as good public policy. KUCB's Alexandra Gutierrez explains.
If the case of Planned Parenthood versus the state of Alaska were a movie script, it would end with a plot twist. Anchorage Superior Court Judge John Suddock spends the first half of his decision knocking down arguments for a parental notification law. He writes that the overwhelming weight of credible evidence at trial showed that parental involvement didn't improve health outcomes for minors obtaining abortions. He points out that the law doesn't contain any provisions that would protect minors from sexual predators. He also goes through research and testimony that demonstrates that high school-age minors and college-age adults have similar decision-making processes. And then, as he wraps his decision up, he concludes that the state has an interest in promoting family cohesion and that the parental notification law is on solid constitutional ground.
We were a little surprised.
That's Janet Krebs, an attorney who represented Planned Parenthood in the case. She says her team is disappointed by the outcome. Meanwhile, the state is welcoming the decision. Even if they're not in total agreement with the judge's findings of fact, says Assistant Attorney General Margaret Payton Walsh.
He may not feel like this law is good policy, and he's entitled to that opinion as an individual, but he properly, in this decision, put those feelings aside and found that the law is nevertheless constitutional because it doesn't violate key provisions of the Constitution in the way that Planned Parenthood alleged.
In addition to keeping the parental notification law intact, the ruling also lifts some restrictions on it that had previously been in place. Most significantly, it allows abortion providers who knowingly break the parental notification law to be charged with a felony. Judge Suddock describes the maximum penalty of 5 years in prison and a $1,000 fine as draconian, but thought that the courts could handle these situations on a case-by-case basis. And at any rate, the state argued that, quote, such statutes have never been enforced and are functionally irrelevant. Payton Walsh says there's still value in having a law like that on the books, even if the state doesn't anticipate using it.
You know, we don't think anybody's going to be violating the law, really, but that doesn't mean that the penalty has no meaning, even if it's not functional in the sense of we think we're going to be prosecuting people. It can still have a symbolic importance.
While criminal sanctions were approved, Judge Suddock did determine that a provision allowing civil sanctions was too broad. It opened abortion providers up to lawsuits if they broke part of the notification law without realizing it, and it didn't cap the amount of damages. Here's Planned Parenthood attorney Janet Krebs again.
In the criminal context, if you don't quite make the 48-hour waiting period, let's say you miss it by a couple of minutes, it's really unlikely that a prosecutor would find that there was enough evidence to convict you beyond a reasonable doubt. But in the civil provision, if you miss the 48 hours by a couple of minutes, then you could be subject to unlimited civil damages.
The Superior Court decision also strikes language requiring doctors to personally notify the parent involved. Now, their staff can do that work. And the decision clarifies an exception for medical emergencies. If the situation is so grave that a minor's pregnancy is no longer viable, the doctor treating her doesn't have to go through the 48-hour notification process. Planned Parenthood of the Great Northwest has not yet decided whether it will try to appeal this decision to the state Supreme Court. I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
The state doesn't have any major action planned following approval of a Fairbanks ballot proposition that bans the North Star Borough from regulating heating devices. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the yes vote has shifted the responsibility for reducing winter air pollution from wood and coal burning.
Passage of Proposition 3 halts implementation of an assembly ordinance that would have set a smoke opacity standard of 30% and enacted fines for chronic violators. That was one of the main provisions in a plan to get Fairbanks into compliance with federal fine particulate pollution standards. The borough and state are working to get the plan to the Environmental Protection Agency by a December deadline. Cindy Heil, an air quality program manager with the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation, says the state has to discuss compliance options with borough officials in light of this vote.
At this point in time, I wouldn't say it really changes anything. The borough is still the lead with our memorandum of understanding. We're going to be working with them. We need to find out from them, of all the projects they were thinking about putting in place, what are still viable and which ones are not.
The North Star Borough's only means to reducing smoke from wood and coal burning are non-punitive, including a popular stove and boiler changeout subsidy and outreach to educate the public on the importance of burning dry wood. Borough Air Quality Manager Jim Connor says the administration is working with the DEC and EPA on additional ideas, but could not share any details. The state's smoke opacity standard is currently 50%, and it employs a slow system of violation notices that can lead to court action for polluters who don't comply. Heil says toughening state regulations is possible, but it would not happen fast.
For this winter, we would use our existing regulations. Doing regulations is a long process. It takes, you know, drafting them and then going out to public comment and then adopting them. Then they need to go to the lieutenant governor to file them, and then they're only effective 30 days after the lieutenant governor files them. So that's a long process.
Heil says the state and borough hope to have a compliance plan ready to submit to the EPA this winter, but may not be able to meet the December deadline. She says the ballot proposition's passage is only one reason for the expected delay, adding there is a lot of technical pollution data being processed for inclusion in the plan. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
When you've made the decision to stop smoking, whether you've tried to quit before or it's the very first time, there are free and confidential resources available proven successful in helping you quit for good. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line offers nicotine replacement therapy, confidential counseling, and support services. Because everyone is different, trained quit coaches will tailor a quit plan just for you. For more information, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com.
For two decades, commercial fishermen and charter operators in southeast and south central Alaska have been embroiled in a battle over how much halibut each sector should be allowed to catch. In an effort to end the ongoing fish fight, a new plan was approved by the North Pacific Fishery Management Council at its meeting in Anchorage last week. KBBI's Marsha Lynn reports.
In order to understand this very complicated issue, I turned to fisheries biologist Scott Meyer with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game in Homer. He also happens to be the department's Sport Fish Division statewide bottom fish coordinator.
Okay, and that is what has thrown you into the halibut fray for how many years?
Back to 91.
He has an entire bookshelf filled with thick binder notebooks labeled Halibut Management Plan to back up that statement. Although halibut is a federally managed fishery, Meyer does a lot of data analysis useful to the council, regulators, and fishermen trying to understand how management changes will affect their businesses. The new catch sharing plan, or CSP, would replace the guideline harvest level, or GHL, plan now being used for the charter fleet. Commercial fishermen and charter operators would share the halibut resource, and each sector would have set allocations that vary according to the levels of halibut abundance. The council chose two different management alternatives for Area 2C, Southeast, and Area 3A, South Central. The council motion to recommend the CSP was passed by a 10-1 vote on Friday, October 5th. Meyer was there.
There was definitely tension, but I felt like representatives from each user group were really trying to compromise and trying to work together to hammer out something that would work for both of them. There seemed to be a recognition that neither one was going to get exactly what they wanted.
Charter boat captain Greg Sutter of Homer sees it this way.
I can characterize it more as the catch-share cropping plan because it removes allocation from charter anglers. It takes the people's fish away from them and reallocates them to commercial quota share holders.
While Roland Ma of the United Cook Inlet Drift Association has this perspective.
In Area 3A, they went with option number 4, which in essence increased the allocation to the charter sector.
Under the GHL, problems of over-harvesting led to a fish size and number limit for charter operators in Area 2C. Ma says that could happen in Area 3A.
Basically, puts in place a catch share plan that raises the possibility that if the halibut biomass declines, they, for the first time in probably 20 years, will have a regulatory restriction and they're crying the blues about that.
While Sutter says his sector may have favored the CSP if its numbers matched those in the GHL.
For a lot of the operators that testified and people representing the charter anglers' interests, they were very, very disappointed with this decision. The catch-sharing plan would have had much greater support had they maintained the current allocation between the two sectors.
Elements of the new plan include a provision that each sector be accountable for waste associated with its fishery, meaning that wasted fish would be subtracted from each sector's allocation. It would also create a guided angler fish program that lets the commercial sector lease quota to charter operators. If approved by the U.S. Secretary of Commerce, the CSP will be implemented in 2014, and it will not affect regulations for the unguided halibut sport fishery. In Homer, I'm Marsha Lynn.
The U.S. Forest Service has awarded the contract for a major logging project on Kuprianov Island near Petersburg. The agency made the announcement last week during its latest collaborative stewardship workshop. That series of public meetings is aimed at bringing forestry stakeholders together to come up with local uses for revenue from the sale. The discussions have been tense at times. KFSK's Matt Lichtenstein attended a recent workshop and has this report.
The Forest Service put Tonka up for sale at about $825,000. The winning bid, the only bid, came in from Viking at $1.1 million. Viking has the only large mill still operating in Southeast and has logged past Forest Service sales on Lindenberg Peninsula of Kuprianov Island, which is where the Tonka sale is. The agency proposed Tonka as a stewardship contract, which means money from the sale can be retained on the Tongass and used for habitat restoration and other forest improvements. At the latest public workshop, District Ranger Jason Anderson said he had initially tried to keep that service work separate from the timber sale itself. The idea was to give the group more time to come up with individual stewardship projects, projects that could also provide work for smaller, more local businesses.
By policy, I felt we were pretty comfortable and clear in not having any proposed actions as part of the contract other than the timber component, and use the stewardship proposal to articulate the types of projects that we're interested in and where we would go with those in the future, to continue the environmental analysis, do the public discourse and public disclosure process. And that was sort of the direction we initially wanted to head with that. Through discussion with the regional office after our May workshop, I was informed that that wasn't going to happen, that ultimately there had to be a service component in the contract.
So as it stands now, the Forest Service will pay Viking to remove 4 stream culverts. 3 of those are flagged as red pipes, which means they're blocking fish passage. Viking will also take out an old bridge and put about a half mile of old logging road in storage. The Forest Service also has the option to have the company do some tree thinning to improve deer habitat as well as some maintenance on the Tonka Road system. According to Anderson, that would still leave around $1 million that could be used for future stewardship projects. Some workshop participants have taken issue with the process. Becky Knight suggested the Forest Service was just using the words collaboration and stewardship to validate things that were going to happen anyway. For instance, Knight said she was shocked that the Forest Service had put the Tonka timber sale proposal out for bids while the group was still discussing potential stewardship projects.
I think it's real hard to stomach when you come to these meetings and then you find out that without informing the larger group, you've gone behind closed doors, I'm sorry, that's what they were, and decided on the project criteria yourself.
The Tonka area has been heavily logged and roaded in the past. It's frequented by hunters and other recreation and subsistence users from the Petersburg area. Workshop participant Mike Bell appreciated the Forest Service's efforts to get input from the public. He was one of a couple of people who disagreed with critics at the recent workshop.
I'm grateful for the opportunity that we can get together and maybe have an impact on what's going to happen around here. And it just seems to me like you guys aren't here to be a positive influence or have a positive impact. You just want to fight.
There have been four of these workshops so far, and with a mix of timber sale supporters and opponents, the disagreements have not been limited to procedural concerns. They've extended to broader issues like the impacts of old-growth logging and the various techniques aimed at improving aquatic and upland habitat. Participant Dave Beebe observed that the group clearly didn't share the same values, which he said was to be expected, but he said everyone had the right to express those values. For instance, Beebe disagreed with the Forest Service's use of pre-commercial tree thinning as a means to restore previously logged stands.
We have a crash in the deer population here after, and that's a legacy of 30 years of clear cutting, low elevation habitat. And this is not helping it, nor will it restore it. It can't, because you're going to have canopy closure all over again.
Money from the Tonka sale will not be available until the end of October 2016, when the logging contract is supposed to be done. So District Ranger Anderson pointed out there was a lot of time for the group to discuss how money from the sale should be spent.
My objective will be to continue working forward with the relevant stakeholders that want to come to the table and provide that feedback, provide input.
Despite the public workshops, the ultimate decision on how and where the stewardship money will be used is still up to the regional forester. The Forest Service expects to finalize the new Tonka timber sale contract within the month and logging to begin next spring. In Petersburg, I'm Matt Lichtenstein.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ann Bryce in Sitka, Emily Schwing and Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Michael Armstrong in Homer, Alexandra Gutierrez in Unalaska, Marsha Lynn in Homer, and Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg. APRN's Peter Granitz reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Breastfeeding leads to healthy babies and healthier mothers. Women who breastfeed are less likely to get breast or ovarian cancer, and babies get fewer ear infections, score higher on IQ tests, and are less likely to be obese as adults. The road to lifelong health begins with breastfeeding. Call 907-465-3100 if you have questions about breastfeeding. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services WIC program, an equal opportunity employer. Alaska Pacific University offers convenient, high-quality, affordable adult undergraduate programs. Applications are due October 19th. Apply at alaskapacific.edu or by calling 564-8248. This message sponsored by APU. Pioneers in Alaska presents the latest local, national, and international sustainability developments at its 9th annual conference, October 26th through the 28th at UAA. Our Own Backyard offers inspiration as well as practical strategies for Alaskans with presentations on energy, eating local, green building, and keynote speaker Apila Colorado. Connect with Alaskans and communities across the U.S. Learn more at pioneersinalaska.org. This message sponsored by GreenStar.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.